It's Saturday, August 10th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. Today on Geek Speak, digital photography, file management with Adobe Lightroom product manager, Shard Mangalik. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio today is Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst, support engineer, and software engineer. Hi, Lindsay.
Good morning.
Bonnie Jean Primch, mediator and broadcaster at large. Hi, Bonnie.
Howdy. Living large.
And Shard Mangalik, product manager of Lightroom for Adobe. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks for having me.
And so today on the show, we're going to be taking the geek news section, and you're welcome to join us with stories and such. I know you've brought one or two. And we're going to jump into the news right now with Lindsay, a bit about Obama.
Yeah, well, you know I'm obsessed with this NSA thing, so I'm going to torture you with more info. Obama announced 4 reforms regarding the NSA, regarding NSA transparency, basically after the public outrage with the PRISM scandal. I'll give you the 4 things, and you can tell me what you think about it.
All right.
Number 1, pursue appropriate reforms around Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which authorizes the NSA to conduct surveillance. So that's the one that's been, you know, causing the problem. So they're saying they're going to review that. Number 2, create a public advocate to argue in front of the secret court that grants the NSA authority to target suspects.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So basically what some people were calling that court a rubber stamp court because they were only rejecting like 0.3% of things that came across. So now they're going to have something independent checking them. And then number 3, create a website detailing what the NSA does and does not collect on Americans and foreigners. I haven't looked at that yet. There's a website for that, so I'll post a link. And then number 4 is create an independent agency that reviews cybersecurity processes and produces timely reports. So I don't know what that agency is going to consist of.
Or to whom they shall report.
Exactly. And so some people are saying, the more cynical people are saying that this is all something that's just PR. You know, everybody's upset about what happened. And they're doing this to say, hey, we're working on it. But that once people have felt satisfied that nothing's going to actually happen that will change what goes on, I'm hoping that people will still pay attention and make sure that something happens with these things. One of them, the pursue appropriate reforms around Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the first one, that relies on Congress agreeing and making changes, and we've been having some trouble with that lately, so we'll see how it goes. I don't know. I'm just glad these things are happening. See.
All right. Well, thank you. Bonnie, do you want to say
something? I was just thinking of, this seems like a nice first step, and the question is, will it go beyond that?
Yeah.
Right. That's always the argument. Well, we got to do something right away. It's like the whole minimum wage thing, right? Like, well, okay, we'll just raise it time. We'll get to a real wage later. Will we?
Mm. Yeah.
So is this just the beginning, or is this really all they're going to do?
Right.
Exactly. I have a couple other things that are related to that.
Yeah, please.
NSA is cutting their system administrators staff by 90% so that they can limit who has access to the data. Some people are saying, oh, that's unnecessary. It's just a move, but they're going to automate a lot of processes that are going to be done by computer and then get rid of 90% of sysadmins that have been working at the NSA.
This is the one that caught my attention, actually. The general concept is with Snowden doing this, clearly he had access to all this data that mm-hmm. then he's leaked. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how many people out there have that kind of data access? And so they're reducing that. You're 89%, something like that?
90%. Yeah.
So the question I've got with that is that, like, I've been in a lot of tech companies, and having a staff that can do what they need to do is really important.
Right.
And, yeah, it's true that those people that are sysadmins have to be extremely trustworthy. At the same time, there's ways and safeguards, of course, to separate access to data and control of systems. There's there's systems in place to do that kind of thing. So I hope that they're implementing that kind of system structure rather than just reducing the ability for people to do their job. And that's the thing that concerns me. I've got a friend who works in governmental stuff, and he does data analysis. And sometimes rules come by that makes his job just a lot less effective because of some policy like this, right? Where all of a sudden it kind of breaks everybody's job.
Right.
And that's the thing I'd be concerned about, doing it in fear rather than intelligently. And it sounds like it's a fear-based thing, unfortunately.
Right. And hopefully this is just, you know, an announcement with everything going on right now, and that they'll put some thought into it before they actually do it. But I have my doubts about that.
All right. So on a lighter... Well, do you want to keep doing? We can come back to you in a second.
Yeah,
let's come back to you in a second. I want to get on something a little lighter. Interesting news story from a few days ago from CNN, and it's basically talking about Facebook. And Facebook, as we know, has the feed that you see of your friends. It's actually moderated and managed in some algorithmic ways. So on an average, an average Facebook user has in their official feed, if their chronological of all of their friends' posts, about 1,500 posts a day. But people read much less than that, read more like 300 when they're really active. So in fact, even less than that. They read something like 57% of the ones that are shown to them. Mm. And the more they're shown, the lower that number reduces. So if you saw the fire hose of your friend's posts, you wouldn't be able to consume Facebook. That's the theory behind Facebook's stuff. So they're changing their policy recently, changed their feed. And the way Facebook changes their stuff is really interesting. They'll do it in large chunks of 15,000 people tests and see how people consume Facebook after that. And then they'll roll that out if it's successful. So it's a self-learning system in some ways. And the engineers, I talked to some of the developers at Facebook and how they work, and it's really much like they have a mission to do something, and they code everything necessary to make it happen, and it's a small team, like six people. They code over to make it happen, then they roll it out to 15,000 people, and they look at metrics of those 15,000 people and see if they positively affect the readership or not, and then that gets rolled out if it positively affects it enough. So it is really kind of I kind of think of it as creepy, but it's also neat. You know? So in any case, the thing they're doing is, it used to be that Facebook was a chronological feed of your friends' postings, and now it looks like they're just, if something has a bit of interest and a bit of comes around and other friends are interested in it, it will surface back up in your feed in a non-chronological way later on. So this, so this is something some of us have seen for quite a while if we're part of the test phases, and now it's kind of a standard thing. And the increase is, you know, in the with the new tweak, older posts can resurface, and the amount of stories read jumps to 70% rather than 57%. Mm-hmm. Facebook said it also results in a 5% increase in likes, comments, and shares on their resurrected posts from friends, and an 8% in the same activity for posts from pages.
Huh.
And I've seen this too. I've seen like posts that I took a photo, you know, 6 months ago, put it up, and all of a sudden, boom, it's showing up again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that, you know, from the geek's perspective that creeps me out about this is that there is an algorithm in place, a piece of software, that is deciding how you interact with your friends. It's been happening for a while. It's happening a lot more. And we all should be aware that we are mediated by a software solution, right? An application someone wrote. And I got to say that kind of thing kind of creeps me out.
Yeah.
So go offline sometimes?
Yeah. Go to a pub, go to a friend's house, and visit without the computers.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm the one that has a computer on my face all the time. So.
On your face.
Kettle black there.
I wonder who the 15,000 are. You know, it's like, I wonder if you take I'm one of them. Time. You know, am I some pilot user that they're, yeah, probably not.
It's completely randomly selected across different demographics.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Cool.
It's pretty neat. I mean, they've got a billion users, so they can do a lot of amazing things with their...
The thing is, I only really contact acquaintances like that through Facebook. Like, if I have close friends, I'm going to be talking to them, texting them.
Jump on the radio every week with them.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I'm not as weirded out about that, you know, that they're dictating how I'm communicating with my acquaintances, because I'm like, oh, thanks, they saved me from going to have to, like, stalk that person's page to see what they're up to. Or, you know, I don't know. maybe it's useful. We'll see.
I was hanging out with a 15-year-old girl last week, and she was saying, I delete my Facebook account. Uh-huh. And I was like, cool. Like, well, I mean, it just, I
there's
like that
generation
doing it.
Yeah.
My nephew did that for a while too. And he's back, you know.
Yeah,
he always come back.
She's like, I need to delete it. And the problem is that I can get back to it for 3 weeks or 3 months. Like, there's some phase where you can get back in. She's like, I just have to stay off until it goes away.
Interesting.
It sounded like it was a, you know.
She's determined.
Sounded like an addict kind of.
Yeah.
Sharat, hi.
Hi.
So you've got a story for us that has nothing to do with social media or politics, but biology.
Yay. Well, it's kind of a social media if you think about it this way. So it's a new study out of the University of Chicago, and apparently dolphins can recognize whistles from old tank mitts from over 20 years ago.
Wow. No.
So so these dolphins, they were moved from different zoo to different zoo for breeding purposes. But the way that they were moved around the world really mimicked the way that pods of dolphins move around. And so the interesting thing is if you take a dolphin that was together, you know, 20 years ago, and then you reunite them, they behave exactly the same as if they were friends the whole time. So they clearly wow. have this memory of, you know, of playing with each other, interacting with each other.
Yeah,
it's the first time that a non-human has ever displayed this type of behavior, which is really cool.
That is really cool. Yeah. It makes sense in the pack / pod behavior. You have to have a social structure, and memory, of course, would be important. So the pod get reunited, whatever. Mm-hmm. 20 years.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to us just eating all kinds of crow when we realize that all kinds of animals are perfectly capable of communicating with each other and hanging
and
out
and having memory.
Social.
And yeah.
Yeah. That's going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because there was like maybe a decade ago on The Onion, which is a completely joke news site.
I love it.
There was a headline: dolphins oppose opposable thumbs, or evolve opposable thumbs.
Nice.
And collectively from humanity, the response was, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Indeed.
I always say that about the cat, you know. The cats stare at you from the corner of the room when they aren't getting what they wanted.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I always imagine they're thinking, if only I had opposable thumbs.
Someday.
The stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak is available up at geekspeak.org. We add the links. There's stuff about all of us a bit. And everything we chat about, we try to add to the site so that you can read up more if you so are inclined to do so. All right. Lindsay, you want to get back to some NSA stuff?
Yeah. Right, I want to talk about more dark, bummery stuff.
Dark, bummery.
He talked about how smart dolphins are.
Yeah. I'm like the goth in the room.
How old? May they never get to this point, right, where they're surveilling right. each other. And
or are they? Or maybe
are
that's
they?
How they know.
Yeah. Oh, I remember you. Oh,
no,
yes.
This is just a quick one. Deutsche Telekom moves email traffic in-country after the PRISM thing. So Germany's leading telecom provider, which handles 2/3 of email users in Germany, announced on Friday that it will only use German servers to handle email traffic over its systems, citing privacy concerns arising from the PRISM leak.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
So it used to be that the way you make a really robust service is you put your machines all over the world, and then the users that are the closest to you use that system. That's a distributed computing kind of trick. And it's really beneficial, and of course it does allow you to split resources, and it just makes a lot of sense. So what they're basically, this German company that has a lot of these machines, they're pulling them all back into Germany, where the laws are more in line with what they feel is appropriate for their business model, I guess.
Right. Is there a dark side to this story?
No, it doesn't sound dark, really.
It's not. It's just related to the overall umbrella of,
When Germany pulls in their interests and focus and make sure everything's inside their country, and then they align themselves, nothing bad ever happens. So we're totally good.
Well, that's why they were freaking out about this, actually, is that there's a government organization that's actually invading privacy. Also, they feel of their citizens.
They're actually much more aware of this problem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Kind of
a former fascist state knows a lot about what that means.
Yeah. So they're also going to use SSL for all their email, which that's Google has an option to do that, too.
But TLS, probably, but yes, SSL is what
Let's just remind the non-geeks what SSL and TLS are.
Sure.
So secure socket layer
is SSL. TLS, I don't know what TLS stands for.
Oh,
but you know when you go to a website and there's a little green icon up in the bar and it has HTTPS, that is what we're talking about.
Okay.
It's basically a private key that you have or a public key that some company has, and it's signed by somebody you trust. That's why your browser knows it's trustworthy. And then all the communication is encrypted. And the only flaw in that security model is if that private key is later discovered by somebody or requested by a court to get, then all that data that was transferred can be rediscovered. Or there's a trick that we could use a different technology, but you can listen to a former show of GeekSpeak, and I talk more about that. I won't get into it now. So I've got a story about an ISP also changing their policies. So the Texas-based Lavabit, which is a ISP that actually Snowden was using as his email provider, recently shut down, and it stopped the services. And so the quote from the founder, Ladder Levison, says, "I have been forced to make a difficult decision to become complicit in crimes against the American people or walk away from nearly 10 years of hard work by shutting down Lavabit." Mm-hmm. And Oh, he says, and after significant soul searching, I have decided to suspend operations. So this is after about a 6-week process in courts that, of course, it's quiet what is actually happening. But the ending result is he's decided to shut the service down.
Wow.
And I'm sure that he was trying not to comply with requests for information. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that's interesting about mail service providers is that the actual server does need to have the email, of course. You can use a technology called PGP or GNU PGP, which allows you to encrypt and publicly and privately sign things and encrypt things, and actually works a lot like HTTPS, SSL technologies, TLS mm-hmm. technologies. But that revolves a lot of individuals managing their own certs, and it's a complicated process. I have a whole, I'll link to a page trying to describe it on my personal site on the show page after the end of the show. But PGP, if you really want to be paranoid, research that. Paranoid? I don't know if it's paranoid or not. I guess if you're being watched, it's not paranoid.
PGP,
yeah, that's the line. That's how it goes.
So you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie, Bonnie Jean Primsch, and Sharad Mangalik. Am I pronouncing your name horribly?
You're pretty close. It's
pretty
Mangalik.
Close to horrible.
Mangalik.
Yeah.
Mangalik. Pretty close to horrible. We'll be talking more about some geek news. And of course, in just a moment, we're going to talk all about Adobe Lightroom, which is what Sharad's day job is, managing the product, Lightroom, which is an application I use a lot. And we'll be talking about that. So please do stay with us. This is Geek Speak. And Bonnie, you got some information about KOSP in general?
Not so much in general, but the excellent program, The Seventh Avenue Project, which airs tomorrow at noon, Sundays at noon here on 88.9 KOSP. Next up, in their centuries of wandering, the Roma, better known as Gypsies, have produced some of the greatest music and musicians on Earth. And that's especially true in Eastern European countries like Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria. And so on the next edition of the 7th Avenue Project, music writer and collector Don Cohen shares tunes and tales from his book Gypsy Voices, Songs from the Romani Soul, and it'll be hosted by KUSP's Robert Polly. Once again, you can hear the 7th Avenue Project every Sunday at noon here on KUSP or at your convenience at KUSP.org.
I've been using Adobe Lightroom for years, and it's a software management product that allows you to manage your digital assets. I think we had shows when I first got into Lightroom, first got my digital camera years ago, where we had a whole month of photography. So basically, Geek Speak, I've been doing it for 13 years now, mm-hmm. and lots of times it follows my interests. Sorry, selfish, egotist. And
privileges of hosting.
Privileges of hosting. I have the microphone. And I use Lightroom for managing my photos. We had shows about the kind of topic in large. I'm not going to cover exactly what it means, but basically it's a database that you manage that allows you to manage and control your photos. And it used to be those systems didn't actually have any photo editing capabilities, and you would open something like Photoshop. Lightroom and Aperture, which is Apple's product, it's very similar, has the ability to actually manage the qualities of the photo without damaging the photo. What is that called, Sharad?
So we call it non-destructive or parametric editing. So basically...
Ooh, parametric editing sounds really cool.
I mean, I figure for this show, you guys
definitely.
Are all about it, right? So the real difference is with a program like Photoshop, you're actually making destructive edits to your photo. You're actually changing pixels, whereas in Lightroom, we're adding metadata. So we're adding data about data to your file, and ultimately, when you export it, that's when those changes are written to file.
My guess is the counterfeiters aren't going to be using Lightroom as much. Is Photoshop.
Yeah. I guess Photoshop would be more the tool to use.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a tip out there.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm noting it right now. So Lightroom, I've shoot in RAW. I use a Nikon, and when I was at UCSC, we also had Canon cameras, of course. And the file format that actually the computer, the camera that is a computer, of course, saves is a giant data collection of all the sensor information. And, you know, the actual pickup on a camera, digital camera, has multiple colors and multiple color sensors. And then the data is translated from what it's actually picking up at the physical world into something that we call a image. And JPEGs are the ones we're all familiar with. But in doing that, you make a lot of assumptions. One of them is light balance. Yeah, everyone knows that they've seen pictures that are really blue or really golden color, and they're kind of confused. What's happening is our eyes are actually always adjusting to light, and we're not even aware of it. This is why cars at night, sometimes the newer cars, the light looks like it's blue. Actually, that's white light, and your eyes are modifying everything to look like the gold is white. Ah, radio, talking about imagery.
Yeah.
Was that pretty good?
It's pretty good, yeah.
one of those qualities that the camera tries to do for you is translate all this data into something that represents white. That's called the white balance. So in a RAW file, what's happening is the digital file is actually being saved to your computer in that same massively dense data set. They're bigger. And then you can actually still do what the camera does automatically for you. So this is why photographers, professional photographers, and even amateurs like me like to save the raw file so you can play with it. And in Lightroom, it's been a while you've been able to do adjustments to like light balance and stuff. But now, you're really able to do like spot correction, all this other stuff. And to me, that is modifying the image. Like, I don't understand. Like, if I take a picture of Lindsay and she has like a giant beetle on her face, I guess that would be bad. You do. No.
That's a scarab.
I could remove that spot in Lightroom by kind of choosing a circle. It used to be the choose a circle, and then choose another part of her face that doesn't have that giant beetle on it, and the beetle would be kind of disappeared. That to me is changing the pixel. So what do you mean it's non-destructive? It seems like it would be destructive, like inherently.
Is it recoverable?
So, yeah, I guess that's the major difference. So when we say destructive versus non-destructive, we don't mean changing the actual content of the image. What we're really thinking about is how recoverable is it? So in Lightroom, because you have a history state and you can, because we're not actually changing the physical pixels, we're changing the way that you look at the photo, but we're not changing the inherent image. It's kind of a little nuance. And so you can actually go back and you can remove that change if you want later.
It's kind of like adding a layer on top.
You can think of it as layers if you're familiar with Photoshop. And, you know, you can have endless layers in Photoshop. In Lightroom, to be clear, there are no layers. But it's you can actually go back and you can say, okay, I really like that picture of Lindsay with the beetle or scarab. And I
If it's a scarab, then
yeah,
it's gonna
yeah.
stay.
I mean, that's like a
shiny.
That's a good omen. And
yeah.
Right.
But if you you want to remove it, you can, and you can always go back to the original. So you don't have to ever hit a save button or because it's all kept in the database. And that's kind of one of the advantages of using a program like Lightroom is that everything's in a database.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the database features, what I've started using Lightroom for really was, because I had Photoshop, I could fix the files destructively mm-hmm. in Photoshop. But I opened up my two Lightroom catalogs, which is like before last year and this year. And together they add up to 183,000 photographs. And that seems like a lot of pictures. And it is. And strangely, I can actually find photos in it extremely fast. And that's the benefit, right? If I want to find all my pictures of Lindsay, I just go to my keyword Lindsay, Lonnie, and click on it, and then I see the 500 photos or whatever I've got of Lindsay. So beetles or not. And scarabs. Sorry.
Yeah, there you go.
That feature allows... I don't delete photos anymore, mm-hmm. and I kind of curse Adobe because of that, because I do have a lot of bad photos. But it does give you another perspective on how to use your camera, because now it becomes this thing of take the pictures, and then later you spend some time kind of tagging them, keywording them is what I've been using. And I guess the features that, as I've seen Lightroom kind of increase, I don't use Photoshop anymore. Like, I rarely use Photoshop for this kind mm-hmm. of thing. So is it damage? Is it bad in that sense?
I mean, I would say one of the things that we think of, I mean, because I work really closely with people on the Photoshop team as well, is, you know, we want them to enjoy doing what they're doing. We want them, if they have more fun taking photos versus sitting in front of a computer, that means that, you know, we want to speed up their workflow, what we call workflow, mm-hmm. in front of the computer. But we still think that Photoshop has a role to play. So if you're taking, you know, out of your 183,000 images, probably 179,000 of them will never be seen by anybody other than yourself.
Yeah.
But on those 4,000 images that might be seen, whether it's, you know, on your blog or on Facebook or whatever, there's probably some things that you want to clean up or things that you want to enhance that you can't do in Lightroom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're bringing them into Photoshop at that point, that's a perfectly valid and good reason to use Photoshop. So it's really, you know, we want to try and demystify photography as much as possible, and we want to speed it up so that you can spend more time outside actually taking pictures versus, you know, pushing sliders around on the computer.
Do you take photos?
I take lots of photos, yeah.
Okay, cool. Where do you put them online? Do you share them?
I've got a couple different places. So I have like a personal website. I have like a Facebook account, 500px, and a couple other different sites. So I'm always kind of testing the different services.
Yeah,
they're kind of.
I guess it's kind of the role you've got. Yeah,
yeah.
I use a company called SmugMug, which
sure.
you probably are aware of. I met him years ago and at a job interview actually, and started using him. So now, one of the things that's so wonderful about having something that your photos are managed well, and Adobe Lightroom actually has plugin capabilities. So this guy, who's the guy, Jeff something, that writes a lot of plugins for?
So there's a guy named Jeffrey Friedel. Yeah, Jeffrey Friedel. So he has like, I think, 300 plugins.
And he doesn't work for Adobe at all or anything like that.
No,
he just
no.
does all these plugins. And, yeah. he, and actually, he asks for any donation, 1 cent or more, for the plugin. And I'm constantly kind of buying his plugins and giving him money because they're so useful. Basically, in my Lightroom catalog, I can go through and find pictures of people. And then I've got plugins from him, from Jeffrey, that allow me to auto-sync those to Facebook and to SmugMug and to Flickr and like a few different services, Google, I think, as well. And what that allows me to do is have one library to manage my photos, the Lightroom catalog, and then allow me to push those photos up to these other sites. And then when I edit or modify the images or add more keywords, they will also, those updates will get pushed. So the syncing, it's kind of like a syncing capability. It's constantly difficult because, of course, there's one guy doing this, Jeff's doing this, and the services all provide different types of feature set. Like, you can't update a Facebook picture, right? You have to destroy it and recreate it. It's kind of frustrating. Anyway, one thing I've noticed on all these services, like Facebook and Google+, which I'm using a lot now because of Glass, is face detection. Mm-hmm. And face detection is awesome because I can put my pictures up and then they recognize, you know, all my friends and everything and my kids. But Lightroom doesn't have face detection. Why are you causing me so much pain?
Well, I mean, that's part of our challenge, right? Like, it's something that we've looked at really hard over the years, and we just haven't found a good solution that's going to work, that's easy to use, that has the accuracy that we're looking for. Because the one thing that we don't want to do is we don't want to introduce a feature in a way that, you know, it looks good on a box and it looks good and it sells a lot of copies, but it's not very usable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we spend a lot of time thinking about not just how to solve that problem, but how to solve it in a way that, you know, in the future, it's still going to be relevant. Because I think the ultimate goal is that, you know, you spend a lot of time doing keywords and, you know, that's time consuming.
It is.
So we want to find a way to automate it as much as possible. And, you know, in Lightroom 4, we introduced a map module, which now, you know, we already get time and date from the camera sensor. But now we're going to have location. And that provides another way for people to organize their photos. That's just very natural.
Yeah.
So it seems natural that, you know, face detection will come in the future. It's just trying to find the right implementation and the right technology that makes sense for Lightroom customers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's good. That's a good answer. A professional answer, I would say.
I've never heard that question before.
So, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Just off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Let me riff on this.
Yeah. I don't have talking points at all.
Okay,
or anything.
Good. It's interesting because years ago when I got my iPhone, it had GPS information in it, right? And so I can take pictures on my iPhone and turn on GPS and have data about where my photo was taken. And so it used to be that every time I pulled up my Nikon, I would also put my iPhone. I'd take a picture of my iPhone and then I'd take a picture of my Nikon. And then later on I knew where I was from the iPhone and I could try to sync up the times and do. And I'm not like Jeffrey where I'm writing plugins all the time. So I never actually fulfilled my dream of auto syncing my data of my photographs to location. And so I've got, you know, 183,000 photographs and they don't have geolocation information. Even though as a geek, I'm fully aware that my location information is always tracked because I use Google search and I turn that feature on. And I take photos and I have the camera with me and it seems like it'd be auto syncing would be easy. And then you told me something that I want you to tell everybody.
So in, like I just mentioned, in Lightroom 4, we introduced a map module, which does exactly what you're looking to do. So the challenge that Lyle is talking about is that, you know, people take photos with their phone, and on your phone, most phones, whether you're Android, Windows, or iOS, it automatically embeds the GPS location into the phone, or into the photo, and that's great. But if you're shooting with an SLR or with, you know, a point and shoot, sometimes they don't have them. Some of the newer cameras have it, but a lot of the older ones don't. So how do you get that data? And so there's a handful of apps, both for Android, Windows, and iOS, that record what we call a track log. And so when you know you're going to be out shooting, you just make sure that the time on your phone is the same as the time on your camera. And you turn the track lock on, and every 2 minutes or every 5 minutes, it'll update your location in this track log.
Which it doesn't have to do with photos, really.
No, it doesn't have to do with the photos.
And this is the thing that Google search app is actually doing on me all the time.
That's right.
I've enabled it. Right. So basically, it looks GPS data and then just records that every minute or so.
Whatever period you say, right? And then at the end of the day, you can email that file to yourself or upload it to a cloud service and then bring it back down to your desktop. And then in the map module, there's a option to actually import that file. So now Lightroom will take that GPS data and that log of where you were, and match that up using the timestamp with your photos. So now, you know, the photos that you take in Santa Cruz are automatically tagged with Santa Cruz, and you don't have to physically add that.
When you're tagged with Santa Cruz, you mean that it's not just the latitude, longitude down to the
second. It is latitude, longitude, and then there's an option to actually put what we call sublocation.
Cool.
Location, city, state, country.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of other data.
So what about privacy on that? I mean, do you have anything that can say, like, if it's in this general area, don't geotag it specifically, generate it, geotag it local, you know, non-locally? Because, like, I love the idea of telling people I live in Ben Lomond, but I don't tell people my address, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's a difference there. And if 90% of my photographs of my kids are at my house.
So now you know that all the listeners are going to be Googling for your address, right?
Now that in fact, it's really easy to find my address because I own domain names that point to me. So, oh, well.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
So in Lightroom, you can actually designate locations that are private. So inside the Lightroom database, it'll still show, you know, the GPS, latitude, longitude, and mm-hmm. all that information. But then when you export it, because that's really, you know,
yeah,
inside of Lightroom, it's fine.
Yeah,
but once you share it outside of Lightroom, there's an option to either remove location, or if you designate private locations, those are never exported.
So that just the information where it is not exported. Do you have the feature that generifies it to a location of a town rather than to your location?
So we don't have that.
Oh, you should add that. Feature request.
Add that.
All right, cool.
All right.
I was making a note.
Yeah, oh, good. Yeah, well, he's taking a note. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. All right. Let's see. What else do I want in Lightroom?
All right. Yeah.
So we don't talk about actual... We're not trying to sell Lightroom here. I know that it very sounds commercial because I love it so much. Almost everything we're talking about, Aperture by... Macintosh, Apple. That's a company. Apple. I always say Mac. Yeah. Apple makes Aperture. I know a lot of people that swear by it. It has a lot of the same features. Of course, some things are different, some and so on. So if you're looking for the products of this sort, they're called, loosely they're called digital asset management systems. If you do, what I do when I'm trying to compare products online, and do a Google search, you fill up the name, the one you know, so Lightroom, and then you do Versus, right, VS, and then Google autocomplete what people are looking at. And so then you can do you'll find the other ones that are in the same space. And that's what I would recommend. And then the other thing is, there's a lot of cloud services right there. So like Flickr allows you, if you do a pro account, you can do unlimited image upload. SmugMugs allows you to do unlimited image upload. So when I go like do a shoot for a day and I'm shooting kids in a play, I'll shoot 500 photographs, something like that. I just upload them all to the SmugMug account, secret URL, share it with the parents, and yay, I don't actually ever look at them again. So that kind of feature exists, and some of these systems actually have support for some of the things we're talking about in Lightroom, but RAW is not online yet. It's not, the cloud-based RAW doesn't work. Hmm. So, mm-hmm. And when
it's
you get
data intense.
Yeah, they're really large files.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, they're so large
files, and it's also that browsers don't know how to render them.
Right,
and
so they're useless, basically.
You can push the data up to the cloud, and that's fine, but if the browser can't see it, then it doesn't really,
what's
there's
the
no
point?
Benefit.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I mean, so what I do is I've got my backup solution's pretty good. By the way, back up your computer. You should have two copies of everything you own on your computer. Okay. So, I carry around with me a hard drive with all, you know, a terabyte hard drive that has all my photographs, all my RAW files. And I also have a collection at home. But to do Photoshop editing, Lightroom editing, traditionally you have to have the RAW file available to the computer. And you were telling me about a new feature that allows you not to do that.
That's right. So in Lightroom 5, there's a feature called Smart Previews. And so what you do is on import, or while you still have the originals connected, you can build what we call smart previews. They're smaller versions of the originals, and then you disconnect your external hard drive. So now you don't have to carry around your terabyte drive. You have these smart previews. You can make all your edits.
Are you doing stuff where I can manage which things are smart previews?
Yep.
Smartly?
So you can do it on, you know, you can pick and choose which
folders
images,
and say
yeah,
render
folders, collections,
yeah, cool.
or all.
That, of course, didn't make sense to anybody that doesn't use Lightroom, but it's a cool feature I just found out about earlier, which is awesome. And you know what? If you don't use Lightroom and you actually want to, we're going to give away a couple copies. Adobe's giving away two copies of Lightroom today on the show. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a contest, and Bonnie's been thinking of a question to ask you. And then what you're going to do is you're going to hear Bonnie's question, and then you're going to call in. And Rick is going to frantically try to answer the phone, and then he's going to figure out if you've answered the question correctly. And the first two people to answer that question correctly will get a full copy of Lightroom 5, Adobe Lightroom 5, which is a cool kind of offering. Thanks. I'm glad that Adobe did that. That's cool.
Right.
So, Bonnie, do you have your question? And then I will give out the phone. Let me give out the phone number first. So, write down the phone number. Phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Okay. 1-800-655-5877. And again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And I think it's 655 KUSP, actually.
It does
do that, right?
KUSP.
I hate numbers like that, though, because I don't want to write down the letters. Anyway, So call that number if you can answer this question.
Earlier today, there was a story involving animals using their own form of social media. What were those animals?
Wow. Okay. Good question.
Yeah.
So what the story that Chard actually covered about animal that kind of has social media skills.
They have an ability to communicate
recognize
over time.
Yes. Good. Good.
Yeah.
Call up. The number is 800-655-5877. Get a copy of Lightroom. And stay with us. We'll tell you what the winning answer is in just a minute. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. We have Chard and Lindsay and Bonnie in the air with me. Talk to you in just a second. Stick with us. You can also like and follow us on GeekSpeak, right? So I actually recently, I was hanging out up on the website and noticed that in the last month or so, we have like something like 400 followers on Google Plus. And I was like, oh, I wonder where in the ranking, or no, 200 on Google Plus. So I went and looked at the three social sites. We have 91 people following us on Twitter, which is pitiful. And then we have...
we have a Twitter account?
No. Yeah.
Apparently the fellow geeks need to follow us on Twitter.
I know what I'm doing
It
later.
Follows you, Lindsay.
It follows
and
you.
And then we have 465 people liking us on Facebook, and we have 200 people liking us on Google+. I find that fascinating. So what I'm going to ask you, if you use one of those services, but only pick the one that you like the most. So we got a little bit of information. Go ahead and go to geekspeak.org on the right-hand side of the main nav. There are links to the social networks. And like us or follow us or plus us, whatever. On them. You can do it on all if you want. But I'm kind of curious what that will do, how it will boost now for next show. So
by just mentioning that we have those things? And
yeah, last time it was like 200 people signed up and did that.
Oh, gee. Yeah. All right.
It's funny, though, that... On the social networks, there. My personal accounts are always bigger than GeekSpeak. What does that mean?
I'm a gadfly. You need to point to GeekSpeak somewhere.
I should talk more about GeekSpeak. That's right. All right. So I am sure, we don't have an official word that we have the answers.
We don't, but our
but
phone
there's
answers
phones
is busy,
filled up.
Man,
so
right
Rick
now.
Is busy. So what was the story that Chard covered earlier about the animals that are social? What animal was it?
You know, I'm not sure if I want to...
You want to say it?
I don't want to say it just yet because there are so many people.
It's true. Okay. All right. We'll find out in just a minute.
Well, the answer will be revealed at the end of the show.
Oh, end of the show. Okay. And the winners.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. All right. So how is it, back to the Lightroom question, how is it that Jeffrey's able to do these plugins if he doesn't work for Adobe? Why?
So very early on, this is probably like 4 or 5 years ago, we realized, you know, the number of requests, like you... just gave me a request for more features.
Which you're going to do right away, right?
Of course. I mean, it's already done, right? So you've been seeing typing. But, so we realized that the number of requests, like the team is just not large enough to do everything. And so we ended up building an SDK, which is a software development kit, so that other developers can basically use Lightroom as a platform to build their own plugins.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that we did that, again, was just because, you know, services are changing, like you mentioned, like SmugMug. They just completely changed their service a couple weeks ago. We just didn't have the resources or the ability to stay on top of all the different services and continue to build Lightroom.
Yeah.
And so we built an open source SDK. And
Software development kit.
And that's what plugin developers can use.
What language is that done in?
So it's done in a language called Lua, which ultimately compiles down to C++, but it's kind of a...
So this thing's going to be fast.
Yeah.
It's going to be then compile down to machine
code.
That's
right.
Yeah, cool.
Exactly.
So has anybody made a plugin for face detection?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, okay. Not interesting.
Yeah.
You can see that one.
I know.
You're a developer, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know Lua.
I am lying and creeped out wait for that to happen. And Yeah, there'll be an extra chill down my spine.
Well, face detection is happening all over anyway, right?
I know. So.
All right. We've covered quite a few things. We're talking about Lightroom. We've asked people to call in with this answer. The phones have calmed down a bit. You're welcome to call us if you'd like to ask us questions about data management, file management, photo management, photographs in general. I'm a photographer, and of course, Chard's a photographer too, and working for Adobe, so knows a lot about digital photography. I'll just throw you a softball and just ask, sure. Like, what's your favorite feature, or feature, I guess you're going to say, that you haven't covered yet today?
In Lightroom, I think, honestly, the thing that I like the best is one thing that you talked about, which is the ability to search.
Yeah.
And I've found that, you know, I take a lot of photos. My catalog's not nearly as large as yours, but I take a lot of photos, and half the time I forget that I've taken a certain photo. But then when I go back and I'm looking for something specific, it's almost like a trip down memory lane, because you look through and you find the thing that you're looking for, but you find the other photos around it. Mm-hmm. So the context for when you took that photo, and that always brings back memories. And so it's kind of like this trip down memory lane whenever I'm looking for something, which I really like.
You know, years ago, I interviewed Larry Abital, who owns Bay Photo, which is a big photo company here. In fact, they're one of the service providers for SmugMug, so I use Larry's service quite a bit. And when I had him on the show, it was early digital photography, and I said, okay, Larry, you're taking a lot of pictures and stuff. How do you manage, you know, making sure that the files are safe and you don't lose a photo? He's like, oh, well, I just print all my digital photos. Because he owns a photo lab, right? Yeah. So, right. Of course he does. And I was like, that answer was so perfectly unuseful to me and exactly what I want to do, right? Yeah. Having printed photos, my father always had printed photos, and having prints was so important. And I feel like that's the one flaw in the system. I don't print stuff very much anymore. And you know, there's slide things that do digital slides. What do you do for, do you ever print?
I do. So, I mean, I think it's probably going to be another one of these answers that doesn't necessarily help you. you know, one of the virtues of working at Adobe on photography products is that we have got fantastic printers in our office, and we're kind of encouraged to take use of them. So like I said, this doesn't help you, but I do print a lot because I have awesome printers to use. So
thanks so much, Jared.
But you know, I completely agree. I think, you know, looking at a photo on a screen is interesting and it's fun and it's engaging, but it's not nearly as immersive as just looking at it as a print. And
yeah.
I think, you know, whether you're like me and you're spoiled and you've got good printers at work, or you're using, you know, your neighborhood drugstore, I think it's really important to get in the habit of taking at least a subset of your photos and printing them.
Because,
you know, hard drives crash, things happen.
Did you guys improve from Lightroom 4 to Lightroom 5 book management thing, the thing that makes books? Because it's one of the things you can do is actually make the design print book, you know, photo books.
Yeah.
Online. Did you improve that at all? Because I keep on trying to use it and keep on running and I stop. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's like I don't have the feature request to say what's wrong with it, but it has never succeeded for me. I'm not sure why, but have you guys changed things? Do you know
so
why?
We made a couple improvements. So the two biggest things that people wanted was, one, they wanted, it sounds really silly to say, but they wanted page numbers. And there were no page numbers.
Sure.
So now you can have page numbers. The other thing was you
I don't think that's why I wasn't using it. But go on. Sorry.
We spent all this time and now you're not going to... No. The other thing that we heard from a lot of our customers is they liked our templates. So we paid a professional designer to build like 190 templates. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to customize them. And so now you can actually customize our templates. You
okay.
can save them to reuse them. And so,
yeah, I could get into that probably.
So now, you know, especially photographers, they, you know, they're really particular about how their photos are shown. It really helps to be able to customize. So.
Yeah,
there are smaller tweaks, but I think, you know, we've seen usage go up quite a bit.
Now, are you the book that you output? You can save a PDF and then take it to any printer, but
right.
You also Adobe has a service provider for that too, right? Like built in.
Yeah, so we've partnered with Blurb, which is a Bay
Blurb.
Area, Blurb.
Blurb.
Yeah,
okay.
So they're a Bay Area company, really designed around photo book printing. That's kind of their business, and you know, we've been really happy with kind of the results, both. You know, the number of people and also the quality that we've been seeing.
Do you think that at some point, and I know this is kind of an abstract future question, which, you know, doesn't mean anything, but do you think at some point that these online cloud-based systems, even Adobe has them, of course, as well, will allow you to do the same type of things that you can do on a local computer like Lightroom? I mean, could we virtualize it and have it in the cloud?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting, you know, kind of being a geek. Like, you know, when I was in high school and college, everyone was talking about going from mainframe systems to like server and, you know, and that was kind of all the rage back then. And now we're kind of going back and we're kind of going back down the path of let's go away from server and clients, which is what we have now, and going back to mainframes. And
yeah,
so it's kind of this
devices.
Ebb and flow. So I don't think it's outrageous to think that in the future, you know, people are going to want to have programs like Photoshop or Lightroom, or you're even seeing things like Microsoft Word in the cloud. And
yeah.
So I could see it happening.
Yeah, cool. So, Lindsay, there was one story that I actually wanted to cover in the middle, and I started talking. I told you, get it ready. So now I'm going to ask you to do it. What's
going
on with Marvels?
Well, back in May, I actually talked about this, and this is the culmination of it. NASA was asking people to submit haikus that would be adhered to the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution mission, the MAVEN mission, before it is launched towards Martian airspace. There were more than 15,000 entries submitted, and on Thursday, five of them were chosen as the finalists. Any haiku receiving two votes or more will be saved to a DVD that will accompany the mission on its journey. There were some special mentions that were chosen by the crew, and those were actually some of my favorites. Can I read you a couple haikus?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Amidst sand and stars, we can see a lifeless planet to escape its fate.
Nice.
That's one. Mm-hmm. And then the migrant rover unfolds a slip of haiku and dabs its lens cap.
Cool.
Mars, oh, do forgive. We never meant to obstruct your view of Venus.
I like that.
That's my favorite.
Mars poetry. Exactly. Geek Speak does everything. All right. Thank you. So we did ask this great question, Bonnie, about, and we have a winner. So I think we'll just invite him on the show.
Let's just do, our two winners were Mark from Santa Cruz and Bob from Marina, who both correctly answered that dolphins were the ones that communicated with each other.
I was going to ask Bob what it was.
Bob. Oh, you're going to ask Bob. Sorry,
hi, Bob. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, good morning. Love your show.
Are you a photographer?
No, I'm just kind of a techno geek. I teach at DOI and instructional technology, but my question concerns digital asset management across external hard drives using Adobe Lightroom. Is it able to, as it creates the database indexing, can you connect and disconnect external hard drives and it will remember the addressing scheme?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can, actually with my own photo catalog, I have the catalog, so the database actually on my laptop hard drive, so the internal hard drive. But my photos are scattered across like five or six different external drives. And so when I plug those in, it recognizes them, and then when I unplug them, it obviously still remembers where they are. So you can have your
photos. And if you build previews of those, you can actually still see the images. In fact, you can always kind of tell what the thumbnail of the image is.
Yeah, so you can have images kind of all over the place. You don't have to centralize them. Yeah.
What about syncing? What about syncing between those? Like right now, I've got my main drive and my main collection, and then I've got a copy as a backup solution. Mm-hmm. Does Photoshop do that for you, that management? Because I haven't done it in Lightroom. Does Lightroom do that where I can say, take this folder and make sure all these photos are at this location, but also make sure the photos are at this other location? Does it do that?
So it's not a true backup.
No, it's not.
You can make a copy of the folder and move it somewhere, but you can't do like...
You can't do a syncing thing.
That's right.
Yeah, I use a backup solution for that. So, Bob, congratulations on winning the thing, and I'm glad you didn't say scarab, that it was dolphin that you chose. And thanks for the great question.
Well, thank you. Enjoy your show. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, let's go ahead and take another call since we've got people in the lineup. From Santa Cruz, Kat, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. Thanks for doing it. I recently downloaded some photos from my camera directly to a desktop, and then I took a travel drive, which I put them on, to try to download them or insert to my laptop. So using mixed media here, and now my iPhoto software does not recognize the photos. It says it cannot be found. So this is the message I get. Maybe you can troubleshoot with me.
Yeah, go for it.
Insert the disk or connect to the server volume and wait for it to appear on the desktop.
Yeah.
Then try again.
Yeah,
volume. What
yeah.
Does that mean?
What's going on is that you didn't actually copy the files from the location you added them to to your computer.
Right.
There's actually two possibilities here. One is that, so that you never actually copy the files over. iPhoto should have done that for you. The other possibility is that the path name has changed somehow, meaning that what's stored in the iPhoto catalog is the location from the file system's perspective where the file is. If that location changed in some way where it can't be found, then it's missing. That's what it's saying. So it's kind of a serious problem because the photos might not be on your computer anymore. Even if iPhoto is saying they exist, that might be just what's called a preview of the photo. So it could be very bad. And so the question I've got for you is, have you changed hard drives or computers? You used to have some kind of network share or a remote hard drive plugged in through USB or something?
I'm not sure. But at this point, I just want to delete what's on here because I can see the photos in a folder, in a slideshow, but not individually.
Interesting.
So it's on there, but it gets me stuck every time.
Yeah, so you don't actually have the photo. You have what's a preview of the photo. So the iPhoto database has a copy of a smaller version of that photo, but the actual original it can't find. That's what's happening.
So So how to delete that? It won't even let me put it to trash.
That's a good question. I do not know in iPhoto how to do that. Shara, do you know how to do that in iPhoto?
I'm thinking. It's been a little while.
Tell you what, I'll do this, though. We do have a swarm of people listening. So if you know this problem and how to solve this problem, please do email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. And Kat, you're going to have to email us as well, geeks@geekspeak.org. If you want to find this answer, and when I find the answer, I will put it on the notes of today's show. And today's show, of course, August 10th, 2013, for the people that are listening via podcast. And Kate, please do participate in emailing with us, and we'll hopefully get your answer for you. And thank you for the call.
Thanks so much.
You can contact us or learn more about the show up at geekspeak.org all week long. And, of course, we're all over the social networky places as well.
Believe it or not. If only you were too.
And, of course, we've got the two winners for the dolphin question, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Shard is the product manager for digital management in general, not just Lightroom at Adobe. Do you have another product, or is it just Lightroom mostly?
So there's a couple products. So yeah. I manage Lightroom and then also Camera Raw, it's a plugin for Photoshop, and that's really kind of the imaging pipeline that both Photoshop and Lightroom uses. So
cool.
Those are the two products that...
Well, Shard, it's great meeting you, and thank you for being on the show, and thank you for giving away the Lightroom to our listeners. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me on. And
I hope we do it again.
Yeah,
next update, right? Come back.
I would love to come back.
All right,
yeah,
great. Thank you. And Lindsay Lonnie and Bonnie Jean Primsch, thank you so much. And a big, giant thank you. That's what I was going to say. I don't know why. To Rick, who answers the phone every week, and this time it was very hard answering
really
those thousands of calls.
To do.
Yes, it was busy. Thank you, Rick, for doing that for us. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. You can learn about everything we talked about up at geekspeak.org. And, of course, you can email us throughout the week at geeks@geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark by David Lawrence and is used with permission. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week, of course, the same time, 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings here on KUSP. Do stay tuned for the rest of our lineup this week. Wonderful shows all week long. And I'll see you next week here on KUSP.